Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello and welcome back to the program that helps you learn and improve your American English. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. June 12th is the birthday of former President George Herbert Walker Bush. This year, Mr. Bush is turning 90 years old. Today, we will tell you about him on As It Is. George Herbert Walker Bush was born in the eastern state of Massachusetts on June 12, 1924. His parents made a deep, lasting effect on his life. His father was Prescott Sheldon Bush, a banker and political leader. The future president's mother was Dorothy Walker Bush. She was an excellent athlete, as her son George would be. He says he learned from her to give others credit for what they had done, to listen more than speak, and to not talk about one's personal successes. The Bush family moved to Connecticut when George was a young boy. In 1952, Prescott Bush was elected to the United States Senate. He served in the Senate until 1963. During World War II, at the age of 18, George Bush delayed entering college and joined the Navy. He finished his training at the age of 19 and became the youngest Navy pilot in American history. Mr. Bush was a brave pilot. He was awarded many medals for his service in the Pacific during the war. In 1945, he married Barbara Pierce. They had six children. One of them, Pauline, died as a child. Their oldest son, George, was elected the 43rd President of the United States. Another son, John, known as Jeb, was elected governor of Florida. In the 1950s, George Bush developed a successful oil business in Texas and decided to enter politics. He became the Republican Party's candidate for U.S. Senate in 1964, but lost the election. In 1966, he was elected to the House of Representatives. He served 4 years in Congress. During the 1970s, Mr. Bush held several major government jobs, including working as the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. He also served as America's representative to China and head of the Central Intelligence Agency. In 1980, George Bush sought the Republican presidential nomination. He eventually lost to Ronald Reagan, but was Reagan's choice for vice president. Together, they served 2 4-year terms in office. In 1988, Mr. Bush was the Republican candidate for president. During the election campaign, he made some promises he would later regret.
Read my lips. No new taxes.
Mr. Bush's presidential campaign was successful. He became the 41st U.S. president.
And now we will move again for an America that is strong and resolute in the world, strong and big-hearted at home. And when I said I want a kinder, gentler nation, I meant it, and I mean it.
Mr. Bush became president during a period of great change in the world. The Soviet Union was dying. The 40-year-long Cold War was ending peacefully. The Berlin Wall would soon fall. The wall had separated West and East Berlin since 1961. In December of 1989, President Bush ordered thousands of troops into Panama to remove General Manuel Noriega from power. Noriega was later jailed on drug trafficking charges. Perhaps the most important event of George Bush's presidency was Operation Desert Storm. Mr. Bush helped to build an international coalition of more than 500,000 soldiers from nearly 40 countries to answer Iraq's invasion of Kuwait.
The coalition will give Saddam Hussein until noon Saturday to do what he must do, begin his immediate and unconditional withdrawal from Kuwait.
The war ended quickly after an air attack and a short ground invasion. Mr. Bush decided not to move troops toward Baghdad or to occupy any part of Iraq. American University professor Alan Lichtman is a presidential historian.
Of course we could defeat the Iraqi army. Of course we could push Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. But what was difficult was getting the world behind us, including the Arab world. And that was the signal achievement of George H.W. Bush.
By late 1992, dry weather and conflict had caused widespread suffering in the East African nation of Somalia. The violence and the collapse of the government kept many Somalis from receiving food and other aid. President Bush sent American troops to Somalia to assist in the aid efforts. But in October 1993, 18 American soldiers were killed in a battle in Mogadishu. More than 80 others were wounded. The events of that day were the basis for the book and movie Black Hawk Down. Although Mr. Bush enjoyed great popularity after U.S. and Allied troops removed Iraqi troops from Kuwait, the victory was not enough to keep him in office. The American economy was worsening, and he did not keep his promise of no new taxes. This angered many of his conservative supporters. He lost in his attempt to be reelected to Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton, a Democrat. In December 1992, as Mr. Bush was preparing to leave office, he and the leaders of Canada and Mexico signed a trade agreement. The North American Free Trade Agreement called for removing taxes and other barriers to trade among the three countries. Some Americans accused Mr. Bush of sacrificing millions of American jobs to lower-paid workers in Mexico. Others praised him for supporting the agreement, which was approved by Congress and signed into law by the new president, Bill Clinton. After losing the election, Mr. Bush retired from politics.
And I think we've really contributed something to the country, and maybe history will record it that way. Thank you all very, very much.
He has not been seen often, although he did parachute out of an airplane on his 80th birthday. And he joined his former political opponent, Bill Clinton, to raise money for humanitarian causes. He now spends much of his time with his family in Texas and at their summer home at Kennebunkport in the northeastern state of Maine. And that's our special report on former President George H.W. Bush. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Thanks for listening. The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. Adam Braun established the organization Pencils of Promise in 2008. Its goal is to make sure all children have a chance for education. 6 years later, the nonprofit group is building a new school somewhere every 90 hours. It has helped more than 22,000 children in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. It all started when Adam Braun was a college student. He was visiting India when a boy stopped him on the street. The boy asked for money. Mr. Braun asked the boy what he would want if he could have anything in the world.
And I thought their answer was going to be a house or a car or a boat, and his answer was a pencil. And so I gave him my pencil, and he just lit up with joy, and I realized that he had never been to school before, and that was the reality for 57 million children around the world.
Adam Braun started working in finance after he graduated from college. But he never forgot the boy and the problem he represented.
We live in a world in which every single child can have access to quality education because we have everything necessary already. We have the capability of educating every child, and so I just became immensely committed to helping create that world.
Mr. Braun raised money for his project by using social media. He paid for building the first Pencils of Promise school in Laos 5 years ago. Since then, his group has helped pay for more than 200 schools in rural areas of Laos, Nicaragua, Guatemala, and Ghana. He says his organization works closely with the local education agencies. He says the officials organize the main program of studies. But he says his group provides additional learning materials about health and water and waste systems. Pencils of Promise also works closely with communities. Leslie Engel Young is another Pencils for Promise employee. She says local people are willing to combine efforts and resources for children's education.
We started saying, okay, how can we get your 20%? What components of labor can you do? You know, what materials do you have you can contribute to the project? And through this really organic conversation, we start building a true partnership with these people.
Such support helped Adam Braun decide to expand his organization's work beyond the elementary school level. Pencils of Promise developed financial plans to help students continue on to secondary school and teacher training.
We are really rigorous about making sure that the programs aren't just beautiful photos and videos of kids, but that we're actually seeing incredible results in the classroom. And if we're not seeing results, then we need to change our programs. So thus far, kids in Pencils of Promise schools progress from one grade to the next at 2 times the national average.
And that's the VOA Learning English Education Report. For more education stories, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Christopher Cruz.
VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember in Washington. We have been talking about the Compromise of 1850. In September of that year, the United States Congress passed five bills that sought to settle the issue of slavery. All five became law after the president signed them.
Yes, I love everybody. No evil have I done.
Owning another human being was legal in many parts of the U.S. at that time. Most American slaves or their ancestors originally came from Africa. Many slaves worked for white landowners in cotton or tobacco fields. Some, like Phoebe Boyd of Virginia, worked in the family's home.
Had to clean up and set the table, toward in the evening.
That recording comes from the Voices from the Days of Slavery project at the U.S. Library of Congress. Ms. Boyd was speaking in 1935, remembering her childhood as a slave. She said she had to clean up, set the table, carry the food, and afterwards prepare the bed. Harriet Smith of Texas was another former slave. She said in a 1941 recording that she did not go to school.
They know nothing about reading and writing. All that I know, the teachers of mine, your master and your missus.
Aunt Harriet, as she was called, said she did not know anything about reading or writing. She said she was taught only to obey the slave owners. Slaves were considered property, like farm animals or furniture. Slave owners could do anything they wanted with their slaves, including separate them from their families, sexually abuse them, hurt, or even kill them. Harriet Smith said her owners treated her well, but she heard about slaves who were mistreated.
Yes, I know times there were mistreated people that did, and I hear our folks talking about them, hoping, you know, that they had to grease the back, to take the clothes from the back.
Some slaves were beaten so badly, she said, they had to repair the holes in their backs with grease. By 1804, all northern states had banned slavery. But northern whites still did not accept blacks as their equals. And slavery was still legal in southern states for more than half of the 19th century. Slave owners there said they needed slaves to work on large farms or for other economic reasons. But other Americans said slavery was immoral, or that it gave the South the unfair competitive edge of low-cost labor. The Compromise of 1850 attempted to balance the desires of those who supported and those who opposed slavery. Politicians were not the only ones who struggled with the issue of slavery in the United States. Slaves, for example, had been fighting the system for some time. Many slaves resisted their owners in small ways. They broke or hid tools, or they worked slowly or claimed to be sick, even when they were not. A few answered the violence of slavery with violence. They planned, but rarely succeeded, to kill their masters and escape. A man named Nat Turner led one of the best-known slave rebellions. Turner was born in 1800 in the slave state of Virginia. Unlike most slaves, he could read. He also believed that God had given him a special purpose. In 1831, Turner saw what he described as a sign from above. The sign told him it was time to rebel against slavery. He gathered several men and in the middle of the night killed his master and his master's family in their beds. Turner and his men continued to another house and then another. They killed every white person they found. Other slaves saw what was happening and joined Turner. By the end of the raids, 40 blacks had stabbed, beaten, or shot to death an estimated 55 whites. A local white militia moved to stop Turner and his group. Almost all the attackers were captured quickly. Some were killed, others were sold and sent away from their families. But Nat Turner escaped capture. For a month, he hid around his master's farm. Finally, someone found him. Turner was jailed, tried, sentenced, and hanged. After he died, his killers pulled off his skin and removed his head. The historian Henry Louis Gates, Jr. studied Nat Turner's slave rebellion. He wrote that blacks remembered Turner for his personal war against slavery, his violent methods, and his harsh treatment after death. But whites had a different reaction. Frightened white mobs killed another 200 blacks to answer the rebellion. Most of these blacks had no part in the rebellion. After Nat Turner's rebellion, the state of Virginia passed stronger laws to control slaves. The legislation included bans on reading, gathering, and traveling. Even with stronger laws in place, many slaves continued taking huge risks in an effort to win their freedom. From about the end of the 1700s to the middle of the 1800s, thousands escaped slavery on what came to be called the Underground Railroad.
When the sun comes back and the first quail calls.
The Underground Railroad was not a real railroad. It was a group of people, both blacks and whites, who secretly helped slaves escape to the north.
Follow the drink and go.
Members of the Underground Railroad helped slaves leave the places where they lived and worked. These conductors took the escaping slaves to a safe house or business called a station. Station masters hid the escaped slave. Then, at night, a different conductor took him or her to another hiding place farther north. The process was repeated every day and night until the escaped slave was safe in a free state, or even in Canada. A black woman named Harriet Tubman was perhaps the most famous conductor on the Underground Railroad. She had been born a slave around 1820. She worked first in a house and then in the fields for an owner in the slave state of Maryland. Harriet Tubman was known for her bravery. One story people told about her happened when she was a teenage girl. An overseer, someone who controlled the slaves in the field, became angry with another slave. He threatened the man with a heavy weight. Young Harriet stepped between the overseer and the other slave. The overseer threw the weight. It hit her in the head. For the rest of her life, Harriet Tubman suffered from the injury. It caused headaches, strange dreams, and, from time to time, made her fall deeply asleep. When Tubman was about 29, she suspected her owner would sell her, so she decided to escape instead. One night, she secretly walked away. She walked over 200 kilometers following the North Star. Eventually, she arrived in the city of Philadelphia in the free state of Pennsylvania. A year later, Tubman returned to Maryland. She helped her sister and her sister's children escape. Then she helped her brother and two other men. She helped her parents, who were over 70 years old, and she helped many others. In all, Tubman made as many as 19 trips to the South. She led about 300 slaves to freedom. Tubman and her passengers were never caught, but if they had been, they would have been severely punished. Former masters were likely to beat or cut off the hands of escaped slaves. The Compromise of 1850 made escaping slavery even harder. One of the bills Congress passed was the Fugitive Slave Act. It said anyone who helped a fugitive, that is, an escaped slave, would be fined. And it said fugitive slaves must be returned to their owner, even if they had escaped to a free state. Fugitive slaves had no right to a trial. Because they could not defend themselves in court, even freed blacks could be kidnapped and enslaved. In 1852, a white woman published a book about slavery. She called it Uncle Tom's Cabin. Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote the book for one reason. She wanted to show how cruel slavery was. Fugitive slaves also published books about their experiences. The stories painted a picture of slavery that most people in the North had never seen. They were shocked. Public pressure to end slavery grew stronger. Anti-slavery activists, called abolitionists, wanted to free all slaves immediately. But even if that could be done, there was the question of what to do with the freed slaves. In many places, it seemed impossible that blacks and whites could live together peacefully and in freedom. The best answer, some people thought, was to free the slaves and help them return to Africa. It was not a new idea. In the early 1800s, a group of leading Americans had formed an organization for that purpose. They called it the American Colonization Society. In 1820, the society began helping to send blacks to Africa. The continuing struggle over slavery will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.